You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello from London and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Ted Kravitz. Coming up on today's programme...
We condemn in the strongest terms... the use of violence as a way to solve a political and institutional crisis. We believe the political leadership of the country has the responsibility to ensure the protection of fundamental rights and freedoms.
EU President Manuel Barroso talks tough, threatening sanctions against the Ukraine. Dr. James Boyce and Matthew Jameson of the RUSI Defence and Security Think Tank will be joining me to discuss where next for Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych and the outside world. We'll also be talking US and Russia's tensions over Syria and today's suicide bombings in Beirut. Then later, we'll be changing tack and continuing our series on Italy. Today, David Pleasant speaks to director Annalisa Piras about the current political transition.
What we're seeing in this very moment in time is that the country is stagnating economically and politically is going to go towards a long period of uncertainty.
All that, plus we'll be reviewing some of the week's comedy from London and be explaining the science behind the science in science fiction. That's Midori House, right here on Monocle 24. So plenty coming up in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But before all that, here's the latest world news with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Ukraine's security service has announced a nationwide anti-terrorist operation to protect government buildings as violence continues across the country. President Viktor Yanukovych has accused pro-European opposition leaders of trying to seize power by force after at least 26 people died in clashes in Kiev. It's the worst violence since the protests first began late last year over the rejection of a European trade deal for closer ties with Russia. The foreign ministers of France, Germany and Poland will travel to Kiev on Thursday to assess the situation before a meeting in Brussels to decide whether to impose EU sanctions on Ukraine. US Secretary of State John Kerry says that is a serious option.
President Yanukovych has the opportunity to make a choice. A choice is between protecting the people that he serves, all of the people, and a choice for compromise and dialogue versus violence and mayhem. We believe the choice is clear, and we are talking about the possibility of sanctions or other steps with our friends in Europe and elsewhere in order to try to create the environment for compromise.
Indian authorities are to release seven people convicted of plotting the assassination of the country's former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi in 1991. On Tuesday, a court annulled the death sentences on three of the seven because of delays in deciding on their pleas for mercy. All seven were members of the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers rebel group. A court in Thailand has ordered the government not to use violence against protesters. It follows clashes on Tuesday in which five people died. Another mass rally has been staged in Bangkok today by opponents of the Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. Monocle's Gwen Robinson is in Bangkok and says the latest legal attempts to unseat the Prime Minister will simply extend the crisis.
There will be a hearing next week. They'll probably read that charge out to her. She has 15 to 30 days to respond. That means another unresolved situation, the likelihood of ongoing protests. Meanwhile, nobody is paying all these angry farmers who are starting to come down from the north to protest in Bangkok. And it does seem that some of them have not been paid for 6 months or more.
It's claimed the Syrian military has begun targeting opposition areas with a new type of cluster bomb, which is larger and more powerful than others it used before. Human Rights Watch has published photographs and witness testimony on its website, which it said indicate that the army used the weapons last week. It said each of the rockets used contained up to 72 anti-personnel bomblets, which are heavier and deadlier than types previously used in Syria's nearly three-year-old conflict. Pakistan's army says more than 100 soldiers have been killed by Taliban militants in the last 5 months. It's a rare admission of mass casualties since the start of government efforts to engage the insurgents in peace talks. The lack of progress on those talks has given rise to speculation that the government is preparing for a ground and air offensive against Taliban strongholds in the tribal belt on the Afghan border. Italy's parliament has passed a law designed to reduce the number of inmates in the country's prisons. There are around 62,000 detainees in jails built for fewer than 48,000. The European Court of Human Rights last year ordered Italy to address the issue. The new law allows the extended use of electronic tagging and assigns more drug addicts to treatment centres to reduce the number of inmates. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Coming up, what you need to know from the day's events around the world.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London, 18:06. That means it's 6 minutes past one in the afternoon in New York City. Now, as we've just heard, the Ukrainian capital Kiev is once again in chaos tonight. Fires still burn in the city centre as the police renew attempts to dislodge and disperse protesters from their positions. At least 26 people have lost their lives so far. And as European leaders and the US talk of sanctions against the Yanukovych government, any end to the violence seems increasingly far away. Joining me now with their take on the day's events, historian of American politics and fellow at King's College London, Dr. James Boyes, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the Royal United Services Institution, better known as RUSI, of course. Welcome both to the programme. Let's begin in Ukraine, shall we? You would have heard in the news US Secretary of State John Kerry talking about sanctions. Not the only one, of course. Various leaders throughout Europe talking about sanctions. I liked a phrase he used. Let's hope it can create the environment for compromise. is that what he's thinking of as far as sanctions? That's hardly likely to encourage that, isn't it?
Well, the man's a diplomat, and yeah. Thankfully an American is using diplomatic language, which isn't always the case, of course. Who knows, maybe it's getting caught up in his beard, which I understand is growing at the moment. It's fascinating, I think, to see what's going on with Ukraine, because, of course, you go back just a short time period, and it was very much within, you know, moving into the Western sphere of things. There was great moves at the end of the Cold War to make sure that its nuclear arsenal was neutralised, and I think people felt that, you know, there was a sense of rapprochement, certainly with Ukraine. That certainly appears to have gone clean out the window with this current administration, and not knowing really whether it wants to put one foot in Europe or one foot with the Kremlin, effectively.
Because, Matthew, if we just want to take a little bit of the history behind it, as James was saying, it was approaching, its closer ties with the EU, then seemed to take a bit of money from Russia and step back from that.
Yes, indeed. It's quite clear that there's a significant amount of people in the Ukraine, within the population, who want closer ties with the European Union, who want to be orientated within the democratic family of nations within Europe, and who are deeply, and of course some would say maybe rightly, concerned and suspicious about Russian influence. Now, it wasn't just a case that, you know, they were sort of given some money. I think there's been a lot of pressure, some would even say maybe blackmail and bullying behind the scenes from Moscow to force the Ukrainian government to remain within its orbit and to reject closer ties with the EU. And that is what really is so egregious here, because, of course, the Russian favoured refrain constantly, especially in the United Nations Security Council over issues like Syria, is we don't interfere in the domestic activities and affairs of other sovereign nation states. Mm. And that's what they say in public, but what they do behind the scenes is something really rather different.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Syria in a few minutes' time. Have either of you detected any softening on either side today?
Not from what I can tell. I mean, you start looking at the death toll rising, the imagery coming out of Kiev, and you really do wonder where on earth any softening is going to come from. And it would be nice if Secretary Kerry can deliver upon stuff. Of course, he is chasing his Nobel Peace Prize, we all know, so maybe he can move his focus from the Middle East to Kiev, which let's hope so.
And if there were going to be any sanctions, what are people talking about in terms of money outside of Ukraine, in terms of movement across borders?
I think it's likely that it will be targeted at certain government officials, and there will be certain restrictions placed perhaps on travel. There could be an EU travel ban. There could also be impositions on bank accounts and other assets as well. But I think that actually the EU has really got to take much tougher steps towards this, because I think in the broader, wider context, this is not just about Ukraine. This is about a geopolitical struggle going on between Russia and the EU. And so they need to make sure that they push back hard against Moscow's interference in their own backyard.
Okay, so just developing that thought, why does Ukraine matter?
Well, if you think about where it is, its geopolitical perspective is of great importance. You know, it's a much larger country than most people would ever realize, I think. If you look at it, it's very much a bridge between Europe and Russia. Russia will say it's very much in its sphere of influence. It did, of course, used to be a member of the Soviet Union. It's clearly got a population which views itself as partly European and partly Russian. And I think that it's probably fair to say that this is part of Vladimir Putin's attempt to reassert a greater Russian control within its own sphere of influence, and is very much distinct, I think, from the approach that would have been taken several years ago by Boris Yeltsin, for example.
Matthew?
I think that Ukraine really matters in this context, as I said, because it really signifies the expanding, growing strength of the European Union, which has taken in such a great swathe of the former Eastern countries that were under communism, and spreading those democratic Western values further and further right up to the borders of Russia, makes the Kremlin very, very queasy indeed. That they are being encircled. But quite frankly, if free people want to choose to join the European Union, then that is their choice, and it's not the Kremlin's for them to make for them.
Because those protesting, those in Independent Square, they're talking about revolution now. They want revolution.
Yes, very much so. And again, you know, just to echo Matthew's point here, I had the good pleasure of interviewing Charlie Kupchan a couple of weeks ago, who used to work on the National Security Council for Bill Clinton. And he was saying, even then, some 20-odd years ago, that there were great fears that if you start pushing NATO or the EU right up until the borders of Russia, you're putting it in Russia's face. And at some point, that's going to start basically rubbing the nose the wrong way. When you've got Boris Yeltsin in office, that's one thing. But now you've got Vladimir Putin, who is very much clearly trying to flex his muscles on a wider scheme of things. I think you can start to see a very clear attempt to push back here and reassert more old style, shall we say, Russian imperialism.
It's interesting how Putin, just finally before we move on, deals with this then, isn't it? He's busy watching his ice hockey games in Sochi and then coming back to Moscow. And where would you expect his next step? How do you think he's dealt with it so far? Do you expect his next step to be?
I think that he actually is going to want to try to remain as behind the scenes on this as much as possible, in terms of not coming out front and making it so obviously clear to anybody who's in the know that Moscow is pushing this. So I think he will really want to actually ensure that he's pulling the strings behind the scenes and that his man, Yanukovych, continues to do what Moscow's bidding.
So stay in the ice hockey arena.
Yeah, I think so. He's a very wily political operator, and I think he has really played a blinder over the course of the last 12 months with regard to Syria and now with this situation. He doesn't need to be seen to be doing everything. We all know who's behind the scenes here, and he will continue to operate in the shadows, I would imagine.
Okay, well, it's a story, I'm sure, which we'll be returning to within the next week, and let's hope not months, but it probably will be. Moving on, let's turn our focus to the Iranian nuclear talks taking place in Vienna. It's day two of, does anyone have any clue as to how many days this is going to stretch for?
I think it's going to go on for quite some time, actually. And the interim deal is set to last for 6 months. However, there is a clause within the interim deal that if there's no comprehensive agreement by the end of those 6 months, that they can go on for another 6 months. And actually, there is a provision that they can go on even beyond that, if need be. There's been a lot of pessimism that's been circulating in the last couple of days with statements coming out from both directions saying that actually we don't think a long-term deal is going to be possible in, you know, this time frame, but we will have to see.
Because even if there is some kind of a deal, is there any assurance on Iran's part they'll actually stick to a deal?
Well, this is one of the great problems. I've been on here before and we've been talking about the idea that there is a great deal of concern about this, and sometimes this is portrayed as a left-right issue, but of course there is a bipartisan group in Washington DC, including people like Chuck Schumer, for example, Democrat out of New York, people like Marco Rubio, Republican out of Florida, who are very, very concerned about this, because they say exactly that, which is that perhaps this is all a smokescreen. It gives the Tehran authorities time to develop this, and how on earth at the end of the do you verify all this? I mean, Ronald Reagan famously used to say in his rather stilted Russian, trust but verify. And one of the great challenges here, I'd suggest, is that we'd like to trust, but how do you possibly verify?
Which is a very good question. We'll see. What would count as success on behalf of the US, Russia, China, Britain, France, the other side of the table?
I think that what we can hope for, the best that we can hope for out of this is probably, I mean, ideally what would be wonderful and what should happen is that the whole, you know, nuclear program in Iran just stops completely and there's no enrichment at all. Because they don't really need nuclear power. I mean, there are all sorts of other sources of power that they can explore here. But I think actually, realistically, we have to expect probably that Iran's right to enrich uranium will be recognized, but it will have to be, you know, below a certain level, therefore that they cannot build a bomb with it, but they are able to use it for purely peaceful civilian energy purposes. And then, of course, there is a very, very thorough investigative inspections regime, extremely intrusive. And then, of course, Iran starts to be brought back into the hopefully community of nations if it can be reintegrated again into the international society.
Just to pick up on that, because that's an interesting point to end on, isn't it? Because if it can be, and you would have thought, you know, this is a step towards improving Iranian-Western relations, but with such a record going back so many years, you start to think whether it can actually be sorted out at all.
Well, that's true. Of course, Richard Nixon did go to China. So a rapprochement of this nature is not impossible. Mm. It would be very interesting to see how that would take place. You'd certainly have to see tangible, demonstrable proof that the nuclear program had been closed down, as Matthew rightly pointed out, almost certainly coming through a UN inspection team or an IAEA inspection team, I guess. You know, how you would make that bridge, who the first American president would be to set foot in Tehran, would be very, very interesting. Whether that would come at the end of an administration, once a president was beyond the will of the votes, or whether it would be a very impressive and brave American president coming to office and trying to open up a whole new world in that part of the region. We will have to wait and see, I guess.
Okay, Dr. James Boyce, thank you, Matthew Jamieson. Also, we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking about America's strategies over the Syria war and bomb blasts in Beirut. You're listening to Midori House.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9 to 5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Insta paper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Past the hour. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, James Boyce and Matthew Jameson. We're talking about events throughout the world, and we're going to turn to Syria. Now, the war, which I think we can still call it a war there, can't we? The longer it goes on, the stronger it seems President Assad's position. We've had some more words from the US Secretary of State, John Kerry, who is on his way to Abu Dhabi, might already be there actually, talking about where next. What have you made of the words coming out of the US and the latest from them pertaining to Russia, actually?
He's a busy boy, isn't he?
Yes.
Hasn't got time to shave, but he's got time to fly around the world and get involved in Syria and in Ukraine. One wonders quite where the Americans are going with this, because if the United States wanted to act in Syria, they've had ample opportunity to do so, instead of which they seem to be very, very happy trying to take a moral high ground, but doing very, very little about this. They're sitting there criticizing the Russians for supplying arms to the Syrian regime. They are certainly providing some sort of back channels material to the to some elements of the resistance, whichever element is in favor this week, for example. When Obama was talking last year and the year before that about red lines, for example, he set his own triggers, which he then managed to get a very clever way out of doing by almost blaming Ed Miliband, I think, and for not getting involved. It really is a bizarre and unedifying, I think, example of the failure of US foreign policy under this administration, that this far into his term in office, we still haven't seen a concrete declaration of policies in that region. And the only person who's benefiting from this, of course, is Assad himself.
Indeed. Matthew, is that something that James mentions, is that almost the hardest part for the US? Because the Syrian opposition, as he says, whoever they are, doesn't actually conform to anything that America is used to in terms of supplying money or arms or whatever it is.
I completely agree with James. I think that, quite frankly, the Obama administration, it has been seen that it doesn't really at all have a strategy on Syria, and it never really has.
Is that because it doesn't understand the nuances of each side?
The Obama administration and the people, the senior experts and political leaders and so on in at the higher echelons on foreign policy don't really get the Middle East. And I hear this quite a lot from people in the region, that they are greatly concerned that the Obama administration is quite ignorant about the region and don't fully understand and grasp the technicalities and the intricacies. And coming back to this wider issue, I think this is most clear on the issue of Syria. And you cast your mind back to the events of August, September, and it was just so embarrassing and also deeply, deeply worrying, because it was quite clear that President Obama hadn't got a clue what was going on and was just making things up as he went along. And thankfully for him, Putin threw him a lifeline. But to come back to the point about the, you know, who is it that you back and support in Syria? Well, I feel as though if the Obama administration had got its act together earlier on Syria, they could have had a much better, more moderate opposition to work with. But because this has been allowed to drag on for so long now, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. And what has poured into this vacuum has been some of the most radical, extreme Islamic fundamentalists, which, quite frankly, I'm terribly sorry to say this, but in many years to come, Syria is going to make Afghanistan, I think, look like a walk in the park with what we're storing up in Syria that's going to come back to bite us in years to come.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, you know, I mean, who is a Syrian expert within the US federal government? Very, very few people. But fundamentally, you've got at the highest level within the Oval Office a president who's a fundamental approach to foreign policy was to withdraw. He became president on a promise to get out of Iraq. He's done that. Promise to basically get out of Afghanistan. Well, that's kind of almost on the cards. You don't then want to suddenly say, oh, and by the way, on the way home from these places, we're going to divert via Damascus. As a result of that, I think you've got a fundamental approach within the administration which says we are not going to get involved in another foreign war.
But even so, do you agree with a feeling from some within the Obama administration that whenever they leave at the end of their presidency, they might consider Syria as their biggest US foreign policy failing for presidents?
Well, whether they actually admit that or not, I don't know. I know certainly in the past we've seen presidents, and Clinton would be one of them, turning around and saying, well, Rwanda was my biggest regret. But there were reasons that Clinton couldn't get involved there, and they had to do with Capitol Hill politics. With Syria, however, it's clearly been a conscious decision by the administration not to get involved. What you do see, however, is always administrations look back and go, well, you know, we could and should have done that. But the execution of power in office is always a very, very different animal, I think.
And then just finally, briefly on this, Matthew, you have Russia again coming back to that, thinking that their guy, Assad, is prevailing in this.
I mean, Russia has been a huge part of the problem with this from the very beginning, and they have not played in any way a really constructive role in bringing this situation under control. What they could have done from the outset was, they are the only people who have the power in that country to force the Assad government probably to step down. They could have used their immense leverage to get that regime out and then to begin a peaceful transition with all the groups involved in a national dialogue, elections, etc. Now, of course, they weren't going to do that because that was against their interests. But they have been consistently, from the very beginning, one of Assad's greatest protectors. And they will have to deal with the consequences of that. Because, as I say, they themselves are genuinely concerned about Islamic extremism on their own doorstep. But the blowback that's going to come out of Syria in the years to come, I think, will make the problems in Chechnya look quite mild.
Okay, well, let's move on into our final segment in this roundtable discussion to Beirut, which was rocked by two suicide bombings today, which killed four and injured many, many more. Rebecca Collard has sent us this report from the Lebanese capital.
For residents of South Beirut, bombings like the one this morning are becoming part of a sad routine. The twin suicide blasts outside the Iranian cultural attaché blew out the windows of fifth-story apartments, flipped over cars, and sent shrapnel flying blocks away. There was a first blast, says this man, who was in his car just 100 meters away. Then, after just seconds, another blast. Residents and security forces searched the area, collecting fragments of bone and flesh of those killed and injured in plastic shopping bags. Ali Shukr lives across from the site. This is the third explosion heard from his apartment in the last year.
They believe they want to go to heaven, but I don't think they will be in heaven.
And while people here say this violence is a backlash against Hezbollah sending fighters to Syria, most say they will not be scared by such terrorism. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Rebecca Collard.
Let's talk first of all about who we believe is behind this. Is it right, an Al-Qaeda-linked group?
Well, that's the allegation, of course. I think one of the problems nowadays is that everything that goes bang these days is alleged to have been conducted by some branch of Al-Qaeda, wherever that may or may not be. I think what we do need to probably wait and see is exactly what comes out of this in terms of some official clarification. I know there's been certain claims made on Twitter, but as far as I'm concerned, that isn't quite official corridors just yet.
No, even though most people
it's getting that way,
will take it as such. But focus on an Iranian cultural centre, an Iranian gathering in any case, which is worrying.
Yes, I mean, this is obviously indicative of the role that Iran is playing in Syria, thanks to its the proxy, Hezbollah. Of course, the Hezbollah group are Shiite, and they are the Shia branch of Islam. And of course, the Iranians are overwhelmingly a Shia Muslim country. And I think it's said that this group could have been a Sunni extremist group. So you see, you have within Islam, and you have within the Middle East, deep sectarian divisions. It's a huge divide between Shia and Sunni. And people don't, I think, realize that actually, over the last decade, more Muslims have been killed by fellow Muslims in the Middle East than by outside powers such as the West.
Mm. And just final thought on this, James, we're reaching the bottom of the hour. All links together, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's a great point that Matthew raises. All too often, this is sort of portrayed as some sort of Huntington clash of civilizations. And I think it's important to recognize that all too often, the West has come to the aid of Muslim communities in Bosnia, for example. And they have a far greater record of killing each other than ever from the outside in.
Okay, that's, I'm afraid, all the time we have. We are at the bottom of the hour. We'll have to leave it there. So thank you so much, Dr. James Boyce and Matthew Jameson. Thank you for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come on today's Midori House. We'll be speaking to Dr. Charles Adler, author of a new book explaining the facts behind popular science fiction. We'll be asking what lies ahead for Renzi in part three of our Italian series. And Bruce Dessau will be reviewing the week's comedy in London. But before all that, here's David Spencer again with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. The United States and European leaders say they are considering urgent sanctions against Ukraine as the unrest continues in Kiev and across the country. At least 26 people, including 10 police officers, have died after months of anti-government protests ignited into violent clashes overnight. President Viktor Yanukovych has denounced the bloodshed in central Kiev as an attempted coup, and his security service said it's launched what it called a nationwide anti-terrorist operation. EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton will chair an urgent meeting of European foreign ministers on Thursday to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. Today, she's been at talks on Iran's nuclear programme in Vienna. The discussions were said by one source to be going surprisingly well. The government in India's Tamil Nadu state has decided to free seven people convicted of plotting the assassination of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi in 1991. The six men and a woman were members of the Sri Lankan Tamil Tiger rebel group. At least four people have died in a twin bomb attack in Beirut. A group with links to Al-Qaeda, the Abdullah Azam Brigades, says it was behind the explosions. More than 3,000 Greek farmers have taken to the streets of Athens in a show of force against government plans to impose tax monitoring and land levies. The Greek government plans to tighten monitoring of income tax declarations in a bid to curb tax evasion. Those are latest headlines on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Ted Kravitz. The time, 33 minutes past 6 here in London, 21:33 in Moscow, and 16:33 in Sao Paulo. Now, all this week on Midori House, we've been exploring Italy as it's the theme of the new edition of Monocle magazine. Whether it's current affairs, Italian businesses to watch, cultural highlights, or the developments in design that are shaping the nation. Today, we look at what lies ahead for the recently imposed but unelected Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. Our own Italophile, David Pleasant, spoke to Annalisa Piras, Italian journalist and director of Girlfriend in a Coma, a film about what it terms the decline of Italy.
Abbiamo noi qui in Italia parlato in questi tre anni il linguaggio della verità? Lo abbiamo fatto abbastanza tutti noi che abbiamo responsabilità?
So that was the President of the Republic, Giorgio Napolitano, addressing various just about anybody who's anyone in Italian politics was in that address. Annalisa Piras, tell us how things have changed since. You know, that was in your documentary a year ago. So much has happened in Italian politics. Some of the people that we saw in that documentary have come and they've gone. Berlusconi, Enrico Letta. Can you sum it all up?
Well, that's a big, big challenge to sum it all up. Italian politics, they are very complicated and messy at this moment in time. But sadly, in comparison to that moment in time that we were describing in our documentary, in which we were showing how people seem to be asleep to the encouragement of the head of the state, he used very strong words and some people in the audience were asleep.
Yeah, we should point out, actually, in the documentary, there's Berlusconi nodding off, literally, he's trying so hard not to. It's an amazing scene, actually. The camera zooms in on these senior people literally nodding off, and it represents that kind of systemic problem of Italy.
Yes, it was what we wanted really to represent, this state of sleep, almost a coma. I mean, the title of the film was exactly that. Girlfriend in a coma is our girlfriend Italy that is asleep. And unfortunately, almost 2 years down the line, we cannot say that the country has awoken. Because what we are seeing in this very moment in time is that the country is stagnating economically and politically, is going to go towards a long period of uncertainty.
If we kind of recap the year's events, when your documentary was released, was the time when we were sort of, a lot of people were thinking, is this finally the moment? We saw finally the left kind of get itself together in some, before the elections, in some kind of opposition, but that kind of fell through. There was a period, there was a muddling period where the president finally appointed Enrico Letta to be prime minister. Do you think that nothing was achieved in that whole year? Was it a complete waste?
Well, unfortunately, if you look at the results of the action of the government, the answer is definitely yes. And that's very, very worrying because nothing has been achieved in these 12 months. In terms of the political landscape, something quite extraordinary has happened, which is the triumph of Matteo Renzi. That is certainly good news for a country in which the average age of politicians is above 60. So he's a young man, 38-year-old, full of energy, full of dynamism. His main message is change. Let's stop this system that has been paralyzed for so long. So a lot of good things are happening in the person of Renzi. The problem is that the political system that he would need to achieve change is actually all against him. So will he succeed?
And let's just hear a little clip from Matteo Renzi. This was also from your documentary.
The decision of D'Alema's government to avoid the change, the conflict interest law, was an incredible, terrible mistake. The responsibilities are both the lack of conflict interest law and also the inability to understand the very good relation between Italian expectations and Berlusconi's message.
So Matteo Renzi there, basically talking about the relationship that the Italians had to Berlusconi and how change was needed. Again, do you think he might be able to effect that change? Do you think he's politically strong enough? He has been the mayor of Florence, but he has never been an elected MP. He's a newcomer to the whole system. Lots of people are scared that he just doesn't have the strength and power to do that.
Well, he certainly doesn't have the experience, that's for sure. He has never been elected, so no experience of national politics. But in that interview that we did with him for the film, which was his first interview in English to an international audience, he said something very important, that he was understanding the very good relationship between the Italian people and Berlusconi. And he has got that same quality that Berlusconi had. He is a great communicator. He's talking straight to the people in the street, you know, he's got this special everyman touch. So that's very, very helpful because he will need it. But he needs to go to the electoral and get a very strong electoral mandate. He will not be able to achieve much if he has to rely on who? On the sense of responsibility and generosity and honesty of Mr. Berlusconi. And his main interest, the interest of Mr. Berlusconi, is not to make Matteo Renzi succeed. Is the contrary. So is he going to succeed? I mean, I personally don't think so.
So that's quite, that's rather a shocking statement, perhaps, that you've come out with, that you think that Matteo Renzi is actually dependent on Berlusconi still, just as we were starting to think that finally Berlusconi was somewhat out of the picture. He can't stand in the Senate. His influence has been cut to a certain extent, but you still think he's pulling all the strings.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not that I think it. I mean, he needs, in order to achieve the reform of the electoral laws, he needs the votes of Berlusconi. And he's supported in government now by the kind of right-wing party that was led by Berlusconi. So he is held hostage by the forces that have an interest in him fail. And he is behind a very fractured and litigious party that is very unlikely to support him completely solidly as he needs. So, frankly, is the fact that he doesn't have a very strong electoral victory behind him is the main thing that makes you think that it's very difficult that he's going to succeed.
So that's the negative outlook, Annalisa. If we can look at the more positive, more optimistic outlook, you mention the strength that Matteo Renzi has, and certainly perhaps the mandate he might have with the people. In terms of the polls, he's very popular. The majority of Italians would favour him, would like to see him be prime minister. That's encouraging, isn't it? He has that kind of support, and people are perhaps desperate for that kind of leader, aren't they?
People are desperate for a young, energetic leader, that's true, but they need to see that he can deliver something. So the risk is that seeing him fail will spoil that chance for change and renewal that Matteo Renzi now embodies. Having said that, you need to keep in mind the fact that there might be something that we don't see at the moment that is happening behind the scenes that might have been the reason why he's accepted such a, what they call a hospital pass, such a poison chalice. Why has he accepted? Maybe he has made some kind of negotiations behind the scenes with some members of parliament that will support him in getting an electoral reform done, go to the electorate, get a strong mandate, and then achieve real change for Italy.
Annalisa Piras in conversation with David Pleasant there. And in part four of the series tomorrow, we'll be looking at the strength of Italy's defence forces. Up next, we'll be speaking to the author of a new book that explains, amongst other things, how the USS Enterprise would never have been able to afford its fuel bills. Stay tuned.
The Singapore Air Show is a magnet for the world's most important aerospace companies, all of them eager to sell to the high-flying Asia-Pacific market. Monocle got strapped in to gauge the state of the soaring industry.
The requirements for new military equipment here are vast and include not only combat and surveillance aircraft, but tankers and transports as well. Patrolling maritime borders was, however, one of the more dominant themes, and that's no surprise given current tensions in the region.
Pushington at the 2014 Singapore Air Show, premiering in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, aliens, space battles, wizards, elves and fairies. Chances are, if you were in the cinema, you'd probably forgive the filmmaker for a bit of creative license when it comes to depicting science fiction. The willingness to suspend one's disbelief is easier for those not totally au fait with advanced physics, like our next guest. Dr. Charles Adler has set about explaining such popular fiction in his new book, Wizards, Aliens and Starships, Physics and Math in Fantasy and Science Fiction. He joins us on the line. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Adler.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Tell us, what do you set out to do in your book? Because you do forgive storytellers the right to tell stories, but you like to explain things a bit deeper.
Yes, I think that looking at the science in science fiction stories, and fantasy stories sometimes as well, to my mind adds a layering, a complexity to the stories that they wouldn't normally have. It enhances the stories, rather than detracts from them. I'm not against stories that don't necessarily follow all the rules of science, but I think examining it, it can lead to some interesting things.
Okay. Sorry, go on.
Trying to figure out what's plausible, what's implausible, what you're willing to accept, even if it is implausible, enhances the experience of thinking about the story. It doesn't detract from it.
Do you feel that, or do you ever get the impression that movie makers in science fiction films, whatever they be, actually take any advice on what is and isn't possible?
With some, they do. There are a few movies I think that are very good at that. The movie 2001, for example, from 1964, represents, I think, the gold standard of movies like that. It was very, very accurate. Even before man had landed on the moon, but it was very accurate in its depiction of space travel. For example, unlike the movie Star Wars, for example, it doesn't have spaceships traveling along banked curves where there's no air to support. The spaceships travel along straight lines because there's no air to slow them down, and they've got rotating space stations to provide artificial gravity. And the movie was very, very accurate. But most movies don't actually take that responsibility to try to make the science accurate.
Well, you mentioned Star Trek there, not least because the act of beaming somebody down would mean quite a rough landing for that person.
Yes, that's right. I think it was the science fiction writer Larry Niven who pointed out that if you believe in conservation laws, if you believe in things like the fact that, Newton's laws say that, all reference frames are kind of, well, if you beam someone down to a planet and, the Starship Enterprise is traveling above the planet at, 6,000 miles an hour, and the planet's rotating at 1,000 miles an hour, then in principle you should land with about a 5,000 mile an hour difference in speeds, and so you're going to get, knocked about a bit when you actually land on the planet.
You certainly would, and we'll turn to books in a moment, or rather films made from books, which you also talk about in the book. But tell us about the movie Avatar. There was a point in there that you felt wasn't entirely fair in terms of a story it told to its audience.
Right. Yes, I liked the movie Avatar. I will say this. You talked about the willing suspension of disbelief earlier on, and I thought it actually did a wonderful job. The world was beautifully portrayed. It was beautifully filmed, and I actually liked the story quite a lot. But there was a bit in there very near, basically at the end of the movie, where I thought that the director, the writers, didn't quite take into account everything that was going on. The point about that is that the Earth people had come out to the star system, where Pandora is located, in this huge starship. And a starship, if you're willing to believe in a starship, and you're willing to believe in a starship that can travel at a very large fraction of the speed of light. I think they mentioned the film that took them something like 6 years to get out there, which would be something like two-thirds of the speed of light. Very, very, very fast speed. Means that a spaceship like that has an enormous amount of energy. The engines for the spacecraft have to be able to handle just these huge amounts of energy. And back in the 1960s, a physicist calculated that if you had a spaceship that was capable of doing something like that, the spaceship, the engines for the spaceship itself, make an amazing weapon just by themselves. You essentially can't de-weaponize it in some sense. If you turn the engines on, you get this huge burst of gamma rays. The point where just turning on the starship engine could probably obliterate the planet by itself. If you have a starship like that, you can't actually turn it on very near a planet because of this huge amount of radiation. And so, if at the end of Avatar, what something would bother me a little bit is that the Pandorans let the people go back up to the Enterprise. The spaceship they were on, not the Enterprise.
Mm.
They let them go back up there, and they let them go home. But the spaceship itself is a weapon, and so the humans can win simply by turning on the spaceship engine too close to the planet. They can basically kill all of the Pandorans that were in the movie if they want, and a whole lot more, just by turning the engines on. And so, since you can't de-weaponize the starship, then there's no way they should have actually let them go back.
Yes. Okay, I understand that. Just final couple of points. Do you have any... you devote almost a chapter or a large segment of the book to Harry Potter and the movies that came from that. What are your... very briefly, what are your points in that? Maybe one point from that.
Well, I loved Harry Potter, but again, if you believe in conservation of mass, you've got Professor McGonagall in the book is an animagus. She can turn herself from a human being into a cat. And, you know, most cats that I've known are much lighter weight than most human beings, right? So you have this issue of the idea of conservation of mass energy. You can convert energy into mass, mass into energy, but at a huge cost, or energy into mass. They're basically 1 kilogram of mass, of matter, represents about the energy that total energy the United States uses in an 8-hour period. So if you convert a human being into a cat and you start thinking about the conservation of mass and things like that, you realize that every time that Professor McGonagall turns from a human into a cat, she's releasing about as much energy as 50 or 100 H-bombs going off all at once.
And that would never work. Just final question, Charles. What do you like to go to the movie theater with?
Do I like to go to?
Yeah.
My wife, typically.
No. What are you like? What do your family and friends say that you're like? Do you sit there and pick holes in the plot, or do you sit there quietly and watch the movie?
I pick holes in the plot after the movie. It's not very fair to people if I start picking holes in the plot during the movie.
Well, good for you, and thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Charles Adlow, author of Wizards, Aliens, and Starships, Physics and Math in Fantasy and Science Fiction. And on that topic, let's take a bit of music. Starman by David Bowie.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, not a soul he said. Then the loud sound, it seemed to fade. Came back like a slow voice on a wave of fate. That were no DJ, that was hazy. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He's told us not to blow it, 'cause he knows it's all worthwhile. He told me, let the children use it, let the children use it, let all the children do get.
David Bowie there with Starman. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Fast approaching the end of the programme, but before we go, time for our daily review segment. And today we're talking comedy with the editor of comedy website Beyond the Joke and critic for London's Evening Standard, of course, Bruce Dessau. Hi, Bruce.
Hello there. Hi.
Welcome to the programme. Let's talk about some acts going on in London. Plenty of comedy acts, as always, but you've singled out a stalwart of the comedy scene. He must be 106 by now, Arthur Smith, him of the cigarette, beer and great voice.
That's right.
At the Soho, I'm not sure, has he given up smoking? Or
he's given up drinking.
Oh.
Because he had an illness and they said he had to stop. He has the occasional red wine.
Okay.
He says occasional. I don't know what that means, but yeah.
What's his show at the Soho Theatre?
Well, I went to the opening night two nights ago and it's on till March the 2nd, so there's plenty of time to catch it. Mm. It's Arthur Smith's tribute. Arthur Smith sings Leonard Cohen. So if you like Arthur Smith and you like the Canadian singer Leonard Cohen, this is the show for you. But actually, even if you don't like Arthur Smith or don't know Arthur Smith, it actually works really well as a tribute to Leonard Cohen, because Arthur Smith does genuinely sing Leonard Cohen's, you know, his greatest hits. Mm. And they're quite similar. You know, Arthur Smith's 20 years younger than Leonard Cohen, but he's got a similar gravelly voice, very lugubrious delivery, very deadpan. So it kind of works really well together. It's actually a sequel to a show Arthur Smith did about 15 years ago. So I think Arthur Smith thinks now he's getting to the age that Leonard Cohen was right when he did the first show. He can do it.
And tell us, you've been to it. How does he take the show in the round? Where does he start and where does he end up?
Well, he draws parallels between his life and Leonard Cohen's life. Some very interesting parallels. You know, he thinks they're obviously kindred spirits in their sort of love of romance and the love of all things literary. Mm. Plus, they've both had financial difficulties. I don't know if you know, a few years ago, the reason Leonard Cohen made a comeback was because he lost a lot of money through to some management problems. Mm. And Arthur Smith says he knows how Leonard Cohen feels because he lost some money when he was dropped from a TV commercial for probiotic yogurt. So they've both had their career ups and downs. So, yeah, he just feels he's on the same wavelength as him.
Okay, good. Let's move on to the Invisible Dot Comedy Club.
Yeah.
Sometimes they play at the Union Chapel, don't they?
That's it. They have big guests, right. Yeah, they have the big shows once a month at the Union Chapel in Islington. But this club...
Yeah, but interesting. Invisible Dot's always got good stuff
on. It's great, yeah. I would say it's the best club. I would say it's probably the coolest club in London. It's like a sort of indie record label. It's the kind of coolest comedy club in London. Always, as you say, always have great acts. And
at the moment, they've got Daniel Simonson and John Kearns. Now, Daniel Simonson, people who might have been watching, who live in London, or might have seen it on the online House of Fools, which was a Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer sort of, you could call it a sitcom. It's a sort of sitcom exploded, really, wasn't it?
Sitcoms cubed.
Deconstructed.
Yeah. Sitcom squared, yes. It's kind of traditional, but weird.
And he played the supposedly Bob's son.
Bob's son.
In that. And just talking about actually House of Fools for a moment, it took a bit of getting used to. It has Matt Berry in, who's did the brilliant Toast of London. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have gained a lot of viewers from that, wanting to see Matt Berry in that. But did you liked it?
I've always been a big fan of Vic and Bob, but I've kind of went off them a bit in the last... You know, since obviously their sort of great period was sort of 15 years ago, and the sort of big night out when they first broke through, and then they sort of, I think they, you know, I got Shooting Stars just went on so long, I kind of lost interest in that. And I think this is the first thing they've done since their heyday that's excited me, because it's just the two of them bouncing off each other, and they've always had a rapport, and, you know, this is more scripted than some of their work, but you can see they just have a natural chemistry to sort of bounce off, and, you know, weird things, you know, objects just come to life, and rats crawl, you know, robotic rats crawl across the floor. I love all that. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and I don't know how many new fans it's won them, but I think it's, the old fans have really thought it's great to have them back doing, because they've never really done a proper sitcom like this. This is as close as they'll ever get to a traditional sitcom.
Indeed, yeah, you can still see elements of their previous programs in
very
all of
much
that,
so
don't you?
Yeah.
And Daniel Simonson and John Kearns.
Yeah. So I would definitely catch him. I mean, he plays the son in it, and he's just totally weird. And he's doing a live show, this Saturday night at the Invisible Dot. So, if you go to their website, you get details of it there.
Okay, and finally, Adam Hills, who's pretty well known, has a bit on the telly and various panel shows. Josh Widdicombe and Alex Brooker. So let's
I've been told to say that now these three people. They're okay. It just so happens that they're the three presenters of Channel 4's hit show, The Last Leg, and they're all doing a benefit gig on Monday night for the Centrepoint Homeless Charity.
Okay.
That's at the Palace Theatre. But I have been told to say it's not The Last Leg live on stage. I don't know quite what they're going to do.
Okay.
I think they're all going to do stand-up sets on their own. It's not actually going to be the same format as the TV show. So I don't want people going along, buying tickets, and then coming to me for a refund. But it is the three people from, you know, Adam Hills, brilliant Australian comedian, Josh Widdicombe and Alex Brooker, all doing stand-up sets on Monday night at the Palace in aid of charity.
Okay, Monday, February 24th, Palace Theatre, Adam Hills, Josh Widdicombe and Alex Brooker, all for a good cause. Bruce, Dessel, thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's Midday Story House. My thanks to our special guests, James Boyes, Matthew Jameson, and Bruce Dessau. Today's show was produced by Alad John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma, and studio manager Alex Funnell. Next up is The Entrepreneurs, and with the Sochi Olympics well into its second week, we'll be looking at the changing face of the Russian consumer. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller are here at 2200 hours London time with the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. But for now, from me, Ted Kravitz, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
London,
to Zurich,
to New York,
to Hong Kong,
to Beijing,
nach Amsterdam,
to Bogota.
This is Monocle 24.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.